evening's programme.
"Till you burst into flame and take me with you, I suppose," he said,
and stooping, swooped me up into his arms and carried me across the darkened threshold. Chapter 112, Oathbreaker, February the 2nd, 1776. He called them all together, and they came, the Jacobites of Ardsmuir, the fishermen from Thurso, the outcasts and opportunists who had come to settle on the ridge over the last 6 years. He had called for the men, and most came alone, making their way through the dripping woods, slipping on mossy rocks and muddy trails. Some of the wives came as well, though, curious, wary, though they hung modestly back and allowed Claire to shepherd them into the house, one by one. The men stood in the dooryard, and he regretted that. The memory of the last time they had gathered here was much too fresh in everyone's mind. But there was no choice about it. There were too many to fit in the house. And it was broad day now, not night, though he saw more than one man turn his head sharply to glance at the chestnut trees, as though he saw the ghost of Thomas Christie there, poised once more to walk through the crowd. He crossed himself and said a hasty prayer, as he always did when he thought of Tom Christie, then stepped out on the porch. They'd been talking together, awkwardly, but with a fair assumption of ease. But the talk died abruptly when he appeared.
"I received word summoning me to Wilmington," he said to them without preamble. "I go to join the militias there, and I will take with me such men as will come willingly."
They gaped at him, like sheep disturbed at grazing. He had a moment's unsettling impulse to laugh, but it passed at once.
"We will go as militia, but I do not command your service." Privately, he doubted that he could command more than a handful of them now, but as well to put a good face on it.
Most were still blinking at him, but one or two had got a grip on themselves.
"You declare yourself a rebel, MacDhu."
That was Murdo, bless him.
Loyal as a dog, but slow of thought.
He needed things to be put in the simplest of terms, but once grasped, he would deal with them tenaciously.
"I, Murdo, I do. I am a rebel. So will any man be who marches with me."
That caused a fair degree of murmuring, glances of doubt. Here and there in the crowd, he heard the word oath and steeled himself for the obvious question. He was taken aback by the man who asked it, though. Archbug drew himself up, tall and stern.
"You swore an oath to the king, Seamus MacBrien," he said,
his voice unexpectedly sharp.
"So did we all."
There was a murmur of agreement at this, and faces turned to him, frowning, uneasy. He took a deep breath and felt his stomach knot. Even now, knowing what he knew, and knowing too the immorality of a forced oath, to break his sworn word openly made him feel that he had stepped on a step that wasn't there.
"So did we all," he agreed. "But it was an oath forced upon us as captives, not one given as men of honour."
This was patently true. Still, it was an oath, and Highlanders didn't take any oath lightly.
"May I die and be buried far from my kin." Oath or no, he thought grimly, that fate would likely be theirs.
"But an oath, none the less, sir," said Hiram Crombie, his lips drawn tight. "We have sworn before God. Do you ask us to put aside such a thing?"
Several of the Presbyterians murmured acquiescence, drawing closer to Crombie in a show of support. He took another deep breath, feeling his belly tighten.
"I ask nothing."
And knowing full well what he did, despising himself in a way for doing it, he fell back upon the ancient weapons of rhetoric and idealism.
"I said that the oath of loyalty to the king was an oath extorted, not given. Such an oath is without power. for no man swears freely, save he is free himself.
No one shouted disagreement, so he went on, voice pitched to carry, but not shouting.
You'll ken the declaration of our broth, will you? 400 years since, it was our sires, our grandsires, who put their hands to these words. For as long as but 100 of us remain alive, never will we on any conditions be brought under English rule.
He stopped to steady his voice, then went on.
It is in truth not for glory, nor riches, nor honours that we are fighting, but for freedom, for that alone which no honest man gives up but with life itself.
He stopped dead then, not for its effect on the men to whom he spoke, but because of the words themselves. For in speaking them, he had found himself unexpectedly face to face with his own conscience. To this point he had been dubious about the justifications of the revolution, and more so of its ends. He had been compelled to the rebel stand because of what Clare, Brianna, and Roger Mack had told him. But in the speaking of the ancient words, he found the conviction he thought he pretended, and was stricken by the thought that he did indeed go to fight for something more than the welfare of his own people.
And you'll end up just as dead in the end, he thought, resigned. I dinna expect it hurts less to ken it's for good cause, but maybe so. I shall leave in a week, he said quietly, and left them, staring after him.
He had expected his Ards Muir men to come, the three Lindsay brothers, Hugh Abernathy, Patrick MacNeill, and the rest. Not expected, but gladly welcomed, were Robin MacGillivray and his son Manfred.
Uta MacGillivray had forgiven him, he saw, with a certain sense of amusement. Besides Robin and Freddy, 15 men from near Salem had come, all relatives of the redoubtable Frau.
A great surprise, though, was Hiram Crombie, who alone of the fisher folk had decided to join him.
"I have prayed on the matter," Hiram informed him, managing to look more piously sour than usual. "And I believe you're right about the oath. I expect you'll have us all hang it and burned out of our homes, but I'll come, nonetheless."
The rest, with great mutterings and agitated debate, had not.
He didn't blame them. Having survived the aftermath of Culloden, the perilous voyage to the colonies and the hardship of exile, the very last thing a sensible person could wish was to take up arms against the king.
The greatest surprise, though, awaited him as his small company rode out of Cooperville and turned into the road that led south. A company of men, some 40 strong, was waiting at the crossroad. He drew near warily, and a single man spurred out of the crowd and drew up with him. Richard Brown, pale-faced and grim.
"I hear you go to Wilmington," Brown said, without preamble. "If so be as it's agreeable, my men and I will ride with you."
He coughed and added,
"Under your command, to be sure."
Behind him he heard a small "hm" from Clare, and suppressed a smile. He was quite aware of the phalanx of narrowed eyes at his back. He caught Roger Mack's eyes, and his son-in-law gave a small nod. War made strange bedfellows. Roger Mack knew that as well as he did. And for himself, he had fought with worse than Brown during the rising.
"Be welcome, then," he said, and bowed from his saddle. "You and your men."
We met another militia company near a place called Moore's Creek, and camped with them under the longleaf pines. There had been a bad ice storm the day before, and the ground was thick with fallen branches, some as large around as my waist. It made the going more difficult, but had its advantages so far as making campfires went. I was throwing a hastily assembled bucket of ingredients into the kettle for stew. Scraps of ham, with bones, beans, rice, onions, carrots, crumbled stale biscuit, and listening to the other militia commander, Robert Borthy, who was telling Jamie, with considerable levity, about the state of the Emigrant Highland Regiment, as our opponents were formerly known.
"There can't be more than 500 or 600, all told," he was saying with amused derision. "Old MacDonald and his aides have been trying to scoop 'em up from the countryside for months. And I gather the effort has been akin to scooping water with a sieve."
On one occasion, Alexander MacLean, one of the general's aides, had set up a rendezvous point, calling upon all the Highlanders, and Scotch-Irish in the neighbourhood, to assemble, cannily providing a hogshead of liquor as inducement. Some 500 men had, in fact, shown up. But as soon as the liquor was drunk, they had melted away again, leaving MacLean alone and completely lost.
"The poor man wandered about for nearly 2 days looking for the road before someone took pity on him and led him back to civilization."
Borthy, a hearty backwoods soul with a thick brown beard, grinned widely at the tale and accepted a cup of ale with due thanks before going on.
"God knows where the rest of 'em are now. I hear tell what troops old MacDonald has are mostly brand new emigrants. The governor made 'em swear to take up arms to defend the colony before he'd grant them land. Most of them poor sods are fresh off the boat from Scotland. They don't know north from south, let alone just where they are."
"Oh, I ken where they are, even if they don't."
Ian came into the firelight, grubby but cheerful. He'd been riding dispatches back and forth among the various militia companies converging on Wilmington, and his statement caused a rush of general interest.
"Where?"
Richard Brown leaned forward into the firelight, narrow face keen and foxy.
"They're coming down Negro Head Point Road, marching like a proper regiment," Ian said, sinking onto a hastily offered log with a small groan. "Is there anything hot to drink, Auntie? I'm frozen and parched both."
There was a nasty sort of dark liquid called coffee, for courtesy's sake, and made from boiling burned acorns. I rather dubiously poured him a cup, but he consumed it with every evidence of enjoyment, meanwhile recounting the results of his expeditions.
"They mean to circle round to the west, but Colonel Howe's men got there first and cut them off. So then they went across, meaning to take the ford, but Colonel Moore put his men to the quickstep and marched all night to forestall them." "They made no move to engage either Howe or Moore?"
Jamie asked, frowning. Ian shook his head and gulped the rest of his acorn coffee.
"Wouldn't have come close. Colonel Moore says they didn't mean to engage until they reach Wilmington. They're expecting reinforcement there."
I exchanged a glance with Jamie. The expected reinforcement was presumably the British regular troops, promised by General Gage. But a rider from Brunswick, we had met the day before, had told us that no ships had arrived when he left the coast 4 days before. If there was reinforcement awaiting them, it would have to come from the local loyalists. And from the various rumours and reports we'd heard so far, the local loyalists were a weak reed on which to lean.
"Well, so, they're cut off on either side, aye? Straight down the road is where they're headed. They might reach the bridge late tomorrow."
"How far is it, Ian?"
Jamie asked, squinting through the vista of longleaf pines. The trees were very tall, and the grassland under them wide open, very reasonable for riding. Maybe half a day on horseback.
"Aye, then."
Jamie relaxed a little, and reached for his own cup of the vile brew.
"We've time to sleep first, then."
We reached the bridge at Moore's Creek by midday the next day, and joined the company, commanded by Richard Caswell, who greeted Jamie with pleasure. The Highland Regiment was nowhere in sight, but dispatch riders arrived regularly, reporting their steady movement down Negro Head Point Road, a wide wagon thoroughfare that led directly to the solid plank bridge that crossed the Widow Moore's Creek. Jamie, Caswell, and several of the other commanders are walking up and down the bank, pointing at the bridge and up and down the shore. The creek ran through a stretch of treacherous, swampy ground, with cypress trees stretching up from water and mud. The creek itself deepened as it narrowed, though. A plumb line that some curious soul dropped into the water off the bridge said it was 15 feet deep at that point. And the bridge was the only feasible place for an army of any size to cross. Which did a great deal to explain Jamie's silence over supper. He had helped to throw up a small earthwork on the far side of the creek, and his hands were smeared with dirt and grease.
"They've cannon," he said quietly, seeing me eye the smudges on his hands.
He wiped them absently on his breeks, much the worse for wear.
"Two small guns from the town, but cannon nonetheless."
He looked toward the bridge and grimaced slightly. I knew what he was thinking, and why.
"You were behind the cannon at Culloden, Donald," he had said to the major. "I was in front of them, with a sword in my hand."
Swords were the Highlanders' natural weapons, and for most, likely their only weapons. From all we had heard, General MacDonald had managed to assemble only a small quantity of muskets and powder. Most of his troops were armed with broadswords and targes,
and they were marching straight into ambush. "Oh, Christ," Jamie said, so softly I could barely hear him. "The poor wee fools. The poor gallant wee fools."
Matters became still worse, or much better, depending on your viewpoint, as dusk fell. The temperature had risen since the ice storm, but the ground was sodden. Moisture rose from it during the day, but then, as night came on, condensed into a fog so thick that even the campfires were barely visible, each one glowing like a sullen coal in the mist. Excitement was passing through the militia like a mosquito-borne fever, as the new conditions gave rise to new plans.
"Now," Ian said softly, appearing like a ghost out of the fog beside Jamie. "Caswell's ready."
Such supplies as we had were already packed, carrying guns, powder and food. 800 men, together with an uncounted quantity of camp followers like myself, stole quietly through the mist toward the bridge, leaving the campfires burning behind us. I wasn't sure exactly where MacDonald's troops were just now. They might still be on the wagon road, or might have cautiously detoured, coming down to the edge of the swamp to reconnoitre.
"Good luck to them in that case," I thought. My own insides were tight with tension as I stepped carefully across the bridge. It was silly to tiptoe, but I felt a reluctance to put my feet down firmly. The fog and silence compelled a sense of secrecy and furtiveness.
I stubbed a toe against an uneven plank and lurched forward, but Roger, walking beside me, caught me by the arm and set me upright. I squeezed his arm and he smiled a little, his face barely visible through the mist, though he was no more than a foot away. He knew quite as well as Jamie and the rest did what was coming. Nonetheless, I sensed a strong excitement in him, mingled with dread. It was, after all, to be his first battle. On the other side, we dispersed to make fresh camps on the hill above the circular earthwork the men had thrown up 100 yards from the creek. I passed close enough to the guns to see their elongated snouts poking inquisitively through the mist. Mother Covington and her daughter, the men called the two cannon. I wondered idly which was which, and who the original Mother Covington might have been. A redoubtable lady, I assumed, or possibly the proprietor of the local brothel. Firewood was easy to find. The ice storm had extended to the pines near the creek, too. It was, however, bloody damp, and damned if I was going to spend an hour on my knees with a tinderbox. Luckily, no one could see what I was doing in this pea-soup fog, and I stealthily removed a small tin of Brianna's matches from my pocket. As I was blowing on the kindling, I heard a series of odd rending screeches from the direction of the bridge. and knelt upright, staring down the hill. I couldn't see anything, of course, but realized almost at once that it was the sound of nails giving way as planks were pried up. They were dismantling the bridge. It seemed a long time before Jamie came to find me. He refused food, but sat against a tree and beckoned to me. I sat down between his knees and leaned back against him, grateful for his warmth. The night was cold, with a damp that crept into every crevice and chilled the marrow. "Surely they'll see that the bridge is out," I said, after a long silence filled with the myriad noises of the men working below. "Not if the fog lasts till morning." "And it will." Jamie sounded resigned, but he seemed more peaceful than he had earlier. We sat quietly together for some time, watching the play of flames on the fog, an eerie sight as the fire seemed to shimmer and merge with the mist, the flames stretching strangely up and up, disappearing into the swirl of white.
"Do you believe in ghosts, Sassenach?" Jamie asked suddenly.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, yes," I said. He knew I did, because I told him about my meeting with the Indian whose face was painted black. I knew he did, too. He was a Highlander. "Why? Have you seen one?" He shook his head, wrapping his arms more securely around me.
"Not to say seen," he said, sounding thoughtful. "But I will be damned if he's no there."
"Who?" I said, rather startled at this.
"Murto," he said,
surprising me further. He shifted more comfortably, resettling me against him.
"Ever since the fog came in, I've had the most peculiar sense of him. Just by me."
"Really?"
This was fascinating, but made me thoroughly uneasy. Murto, Jamie's godfather, had died at Culloden, and, so far as I knew, hadn't been going about manifesting himself since. I didn't doubt his presence. Murtaugh's had been an extremely strong, if dour, personality. And if Jamie said he was there, he very likely was. What made me uneasy was the contemplation of just why he might be there. I concentrated for a time, but got no sense of the tough little Scotsman myself. Evidently, he was only interested in Jamie. That frightened me. While the conclusion of the morrow's battle was a foregone one, a battle was a battle, and men might be killed on the winning side as well. Murto had been Jamie's godfather and took his duty to Jamie seriously. I sincerely hoped he hadn't had word that Jamie was about to be killed and shown up to conduct him to heaven. Visions on the eve of battle were a fairly common occurrence in Highland lore. But Jamie did say he hadn't seen Murto. That was something, I supposed.
He hasn't said anything to you, has he?
Jamie shook his head, seeming unfazed by this ghostly visitation.
Nay, he's just there.
He seemed, in fact, to find this there-ness a comfort. And so I didn't voice my own doubts and fears. I had them, nonetheless, and spent the rest of the short night pressed close against my husband, as though daring Murto or anyone else to take him from me. Chapter 113. The Ghosts of Culloden. Come dawn, Roger stood behind the low earthwork by his father-in-law, musket in hand, straining his eyes to peer into the mist. The sounds of an army came to him clearly, sound carried through fog. The measured tramp of feet, though they were not marching in any sort of unison, the clank of metal and rustle of cloth, voices, the shouts of officers, he thought, beginning to rally their troops. They would by now have found the deserted campfires. They'd know that the enemy now lay across the creek. The smell of tallow was strong in the air. Alexander Lillington's men had greased the support timbers after the planks had been removed. He'd been grasping his gun for hours, it seemed,
and yet the metal was still cold in his hand. His fingers were stiff.
"Do you hear the shouting?"
Jamie nodded toward the mist that hid the far bank. The wind had changed. No more than disconnected Gaelic phrases came from beyond the ghostly cypress trunks, and I made no sense of them. Jamie did.
"Whoever's leading them, I think it's MacLeod by the voice. He means to charge the creek," he said.
"But that's suicide," Roger blurted. "Surely they knew. Surely someone's seen the bridge."
"They are Highlanders," Jamie said, still softly, eyes on the ramrod he pulled from its rest. "They will follow the man to whom they vow loyalty, even though he leads them to their death."
Ian was nearby. He glanced quickly toward Roger, then over his shoulder, where Kenny and Murdo Lindsay stood with Ronnie Sinclair and the MacGillivrays. They stood in a casual knot, but every hand touched a musket or rifle, and their eyes darted toward Jamie every few seconds. They had joined Colonel Lillington's men on this side of the creek. Lillington was passing to and fro through the men, eyes darting back and forth, assessing readiness. Lillington stopped abruptly at sight of Jamie, and Roger felt a nervous qualm in the pit of his stomach. Randall Lillington had been a second cousin of the Colonel's. Alexander Lillington wasn't a man to hide his thoughts. It had quite evidently dawned on him that his own men were 40 feet away, and that Jamie's men stood between him and them. His eyes darted toward the mist where Donald MacLeod's bellowing was being answered by increasing roars from the Highlanders with him, then back at Jamie.
"What does he say?" Lillington demanded, rising on his toes and frowning toward the far bank as though concentration might yield him meaning. "He says to them that courage will carry the day."
Jamie glanced toward the crest of the rise behind them. Mother Covington's long black snout was just visible through the mist.
"Would that it could," he added quietly in Gaelic.
Alexander Lillington reached out suddenly and grabbed Jamie's wrist.
"And you, sir," he said, suspicion open in eyes and voice. "Are you not a Highlander as well?"
Lillington's other hand was on the pistol in his belt. Roger felt the casual talk among the men behind him stop and glanced back. All Jamie's men were watching, with expressions of great interest but no particular alarm. Evidently, they felt Jamie could deal with Lillington by himself.
"I ask you, sir, to whom is your loyalty?"
"Where do I stand, sir?" Jamie said with elaborate politeness. "On this side of the creek, or on that?"
A few men grinned at that, but forbore to laugh. The question of loyalty was a raw one still, and no man would risk it unnecessarily. Lillington's grip on his wrist relaxed, but didn't yet let go, though he acknowledged Jamie's statement with a nod.
"Well enough. But how are we to know that you do not mean to turn and fall upon us in battle? For you are a Highlander, are you not? And your men?"
"I am a Highlander," Jamie said bleakly.
He glanced once more at the far bank where occasional glimpses of tartan showed through the mist, and then back. The shouting echoed from the fog.
"And I am the sire of Americans."
He pulled his wrist from Lillington's grasp.
"And I give you leave, sir,"
he continued evenly, lifting his rifle and standing it on its butt,
"to stand behind me and thrust your sword through my heart if I fire amiss."
With that, he turned his back on Lillington and loaded his gun, ramming ball, powder, and patch with great precision. A voice bellowed from the fog, and 100 other throats took up the cry in Gaelic, "King George and Broadswords!" The last Highland charge had begun. They burst out of the mist 100 feet from the bridge, howling, and his heart jumped in his chest. For an instant only, he felt he ran with them, and the wind of it snapped in his shirt, cold on his body. But he stood stock still, Murtaugh beside him, looking cynically on. Roger Mack coughed, and Jamie raised the rifle to his shoulder, waiting.
Fire!
The volley struck them just before they reached the gutted bridge. Half a dozen fell in the road, but the others came on. Then the cannon fired from the hill above, one and then the other, and the concussion of their discharge was like a shove against his back. He had fired with the volley, aiming above their heads. Now swung the rifle down and pulled the ramrod. There was screaming on both sides, the shriek of the wounded, and the stronger bellowing of battle.
Ari! Ari! The king! The king!
MacLeod was at the bridge. He'd been hit. There was blood on his coat. But he brandished sword and targe and ran onto the bridge, stabbing his sword into the wood to anchor himself. The cannon spoke again, but were aimed too high. Most of the Highlanders had crowded down to the banks of the creek. Some were in the water, clinging to the bridge supports, inching across. More were on the timbers, slipping, using their swords like MacLeod to keep their balance.
Fire!
And he fired, powder smoke blending with the fog. The cannon had the range. They spoke, one, two, and he felt the blast push against him, felt as though the shot had torn through him. Most of those on the bridge were in the water now. More threw themselves flat upon the timbers, trying to wriggle their way across, only to be picked off by the muskets, every man firing at will from the redoubt. He loaded and fired.
"There he is," said a voice, dispassionate.
He had no notion, was it his or Murtaugh's? MacLeod was dead, his body floating in the creek for an instant before the weight of the black water pulled him down. Many men were struggling in that water. The creek was deep here and mortal cold. Few Highlanders could swim. He glimpsed Alan MacDonald, Flora's husband, pale and staring in the crowd on the shore. Major Donald MacDonald floundered, rising halfway in the water. His wig was gone, and his head showed bare and wounded, blood running from his scalp down over his face. His teeth were bared, clenched in agony or ferocity. There was no telling which. Another shot struck him, and he fell with a splash, but rose again, slow, slow, and then pitched forward into water too deep to stand, but rose yet again, splashing frantically, spraying blood from his shattered mouth in the effort to breathe.
"Let it be you then, lad," said the dispassionate voice.
He raised his rifle and shot MacDonald cleanly through the throat. He fell backward and sank at once. It was over in minutes, the fog thick with powder smoke, the black creek choked with the dying and dead.
"King George and broadswords, eh?"
said Caswell, bleakly surveying the damage.
"Broadswords against cannon. Poor buggers."
On the other side, all was confusion. Those who hadn't fallen at the bridge were in flight. Already, men on this side of the creek were carrying the timbers down to repair the bridge. Those who were running wouldn't get far. He should go, too, summon his men to help in pursuit. But he stood, as though turned to stone, the cold wind singing in his ears. Jack Randall stood still. His sword was in his hand, but he made no effort to raise it. Only he stood there, that odd smile on his lips, dark eyes burning in Jamie's own. If he had been able to break that gaze. But he couldn't. And so, caught the blur of movement behind Randall, Murtaugh, running, bounding tussocks like a sheep. And the glint of his godfather's blade. Had he seen that? Or only imagined it? No matter. He'd known without doubt from the cock of Murtaugh's arm, and seen before it happened the murderous strike come upward toward the captain's red-clad back. Randall spun, warned maybe by some change in his eyes, the sob of Murtaugh's breath, or only by a soldier's instinct. Too late to avoid the thrust, but soon enough that the dirk missed its fatal aim into the kidney. Randall had grunted with the blow. Christ, he could hear it. And jerked aside, staggering, but turning as he fell, grasping Murtaugh's wrist, dragging him down in a shower of spray from the wet gorse they fell through. They had rolled away into a hollow, locked together, struggling, and he had flung himself through the clinging plants in pursuit. Some weapon, what? What had he held in his fist? But the feel of it faded against his skin. He felt the weight of the thing in his hand, but there was no shape of hilt or trigger to remind him, and it was gone again. Leaving him with that one image, Murtaugh. Murtaugh, teeth clenched and bare as he struck. Murtaugh running, coming to save him. He became slowly aware again of where he was. There was a hand on his arm. Roger Mack, white-faced but steady.
"I am going to see to them," Roger Mack said, with a brief nod toward the creek. "You're all right yourself?"
"Aye, of course," he said,
though with the feeling he so often had in waking from a dream, as though he were not, in fact, quite real. Roger Mack nodded and turned to walk away, then suddenly turned back and, laying his hand once more on Jamie's arm, said very quietly,
"Ego te absolvo."
Then turned again and went resolutely to tend the dying and bless the dead. Part 12. Time will not be ours forever. Chapter 114. Amanda. From Longyon, Intelligencer, May the 15th, 1776. Independence. In the wake of the famous victory at Moore's Creek Bridge, the 4th Provincial Congress of North Carolina has voted to adopt the Halifax Resolves. These resolutions authorize delegates to the Continental Congress to concur with the other delegates of the other colonies in declaring independency and forming foreign alliances, reserving to this colony the sole and exclusive right of forming a constitution and laws for this colony, and by passage of the Halifax Resolves, North Carolina thus becomes the first colony officially to endorse independency. The first ship of a fleet commanded by Sir Peter Parker has arrived at the mouth of the Cape Fear River upon the 18th of April. The fleet consists of 9 ships in total and is bringing British troops to pacify and unite the colony by word of Governor Josiah Martin. Stolen. Goods amounting to £26.10.04 in total, abstracted from the warehouse of Mr. Neil Forbes on Water Street. Thieves broke a hole in the back of the warehouse during the night of May the 12th and carried the goods away by means of a wagon. 2 men, 1 white, 1 black, were seen driving a wagon away with a team of bay mules. Any word pertaining to this atrocious crime will be generously rewarded. Apply to W. Jones, in care of the Gull and Oyster, on the Market Square. Born to Captain Roger Mackenzie of Fraser's Ridge and his lady, a girl, on the 21st of April. Child and mother are reported in good health, the child's name given as Amanda Claire Hope Mackenzie. Roger had never felt so terrified as he did when his newborn daughter was placed in his arms for the first time. Minutes old, skin tender and perfect as an orchid's, she was so delicate he feared he would leave fingerprints on her, but so alluring that he had to touch her, drawing the back of his knuckle gently, so gently, down the perfect curve of her fat little cheek, stroking the black cobweb silk of her hair with an unbelieving forefinger.
She looks like you.
Brianna, sweaty, dishevelled, deflated, and so beautiful he could scarcely bear to look at her, lay back against the pillows with a grin that came and went like the Cheshire cat's, never entirely absent, even though it faded now and then from tiredness.
Does she?
He studied the tiny face with complete absorption, not for any sign of himself, only because he couldn't take his eyes off her. He had come to know her intimately through the months of being roused suddenly by pokes and kicks, of watching the liquid heave of Brianna's belly, of feeling the little one swell and retreat under his hands as he lay behind his wife, cupping her stomach and making jokes. But he'd known her as Little Otto, the private name they'd used for the unborn child. Otto had had a distinct personality, and for a moment he felt a ridiculous pang of loss, realizing that Otto was gone. This tiny, exquisite being was someone entirely new.
Is she Marjorie, do you think?
Bree was lifting her head, peering at the blanket-wrapped bundle. They'd discussed names for months, making lists, arguing, making fun of each other's choices, choosing ridiculous things like Montgomery or Agatha. At last, tentatively, they decided that if it was a boy, the name might be Michael. If a girl, Marjorie, after Roger's mother. His daughter opened her eyes quite suddenly and looked at him. Her eyes were slanted. He wondered if they would stay that way, like her mother's. A sort of soft, middle blue, like the sky in mid-morning. Nothing remarkable at a glance. When you looked straight into it, vast, illimitable. No, he said softly, staring into those eyes. Could she see him yet? He wondered. No, he said again. Her name's Amanda. I hadn't said anything to begin with. It was a common thing in newborns, especially babies born a bit early, as Amanda had been. Nothing to worry about. The ductus arteriosus is a small blood vessel that in the fetus joins the aorta to the pulmonary artery. Babies have lungs, of course, but prior to birth don't use them. All their oxygen comes from the placenta via the umbilical cord. Ergo, no need for blood to be circulated to the lungs, save to nourish the developing tissue. And so the ductus arteriosus bypasses the pulmonary circulation. At birth, though, the baby takes its first breath, and oxygen sensors in this small vessel causes it to contract and close permanently. With the ductus arteriosus closed, blood heads out from the heart to the lungs, picks up oxygen, and comes back to be pumped out to the rest of the body. A neat and elegant system. Save that it doesn't always work properly. The ductus arteriosus doesn't always close. If it doesn't, blood still goes to the lungs, of course. But the bypass is still there. Too much blood goes to the lungs in some cases and floods them. The lungs swell, become congested, and with diverted blood flow to the body, there are problems with oxygenation, which can become acute. I moved my stethoscope over the tiny chest, ear pressed to it, listening intently. It was my best stethoscope, a model from the 19th century called a Pinard, a bell with a flattened disc at one end to which I pressed my ear. I had one carved of wood. This one was made of pewter. Brianna had sandcast it for me. In fact, though, the murmur was so distinct that I felt as though I barely needed a stethoscope. Not a click or a misplaced beat. Not a too long pause or a leaky swish. There were any number of unusual sounds a heart could make, and auscultation was the first step of diagnosis. Atrial defects, ventral defects, malformed valves all have specific murmurs, some occurring between beats, some blending with the heart sounds. When the ductus arteriosus fails to close, it is said to be patent, open. A patent ductus arteriosus makes a continuous shushing murmur, soft but audible, with a little concentration, particularly in the supraclavicular and cervical regions. For the 100th time in 2 days, I bent close, ear pressed to the penard as I moved it over Amanda's neck and chest, hoping against hope that the sound would have disappeared. It hadn't.
"Turn your head, lovey."
"Yes, that's right," I breathed, delicately turning her head away from me, penard pressed to the side of her neck. It was hard to get the stethoscope close to her fat little neck.
"There."
The murmur increased. Amanda made a little breathy noise that sounded like a giggle. I brought her head back the other way. The sound decreased. "Oh, bloody hell," I said softly, so as not to scare her. I put down the penard and picked her up, cradling her against my shoulder. We were alone. Brianna had gone up to my room for a nap, and everyone else was out. I carried her to the surgery window and looked out. It was a beautiful day in the mountain spring. The wrens were nesting under the eaves again. I could hear them above me, rustling round with sticks, conversing in small, clear chirps.
"Bird," I said,
my lips close to her tiny seashell of an ear.
"Noisy bird."
She squirmed lazily and farted in reply.
"Right," I said, smiling despite myself.
I held her out a little so I could look into her face. Lovely, perfect, but not as fat as it had been when she was born a week before. It was perfectly normal for babies to lose a little weight at first, I told myself. It was. A patent ductus arteriosus may have no symptoms beyond that odd, continuous murmur. But it may. A bad one deprives the child of needed oxygen. The main symptoms are pulmonary, wheezing, rapid, shallow breathing, bad colour, and failure to thrive because of the energy burned up in the effort to get enough oxygen.
"Just let Granny have a little listen again," I said, laying her down on the quilt I'd spread over the surgery table.
She gurgled and kicked as I picked up the penard and placed it on her chest again, moving it over neck, shoulder, arm. "Oh, Jesus," I whispered, closing my eyes. "Don't let it be bad." But the sound of the murmur seemed to grow louder, drowning my prayers. I opened my eyes to see Brianna standing in the doorway. "I knew there was something wrong," she said steadily, wiping Mandy's bottom with a damp rag before re-diapering her. "She doesn't nurse like Jemmy did. She acts hungry, but she'll only nurse for a few minutes before she falls asleep. Then she wakes up and fusses again a few minutes later." She sat down and offered Mandy a breast, as though in illustration of the difficulty. Sure enough, the baby latched on with every evidence of starvation. As she nursed, I picked up one of the tiny fists, unfolding her fingers. The minute nails were faintly tinged with blue.
"So," Brianna said calmly, "what happens now?"
"I don't know." This was the usual answer in most cases, truth be told, but it was always unsatisfactory and clearly not less so now. "Sometimes there are no symptoms, or only very minor ones," I said, trying for amendment. "If the opening is very large and you have pulmonary symptoms, and we have, then she might be all right. Only not thriving, not growing properly because of the feeding difficulties. Or..." I took a deep breath, steeling myself. "She could develop heart failure, or pulmonary hypertension. That's a very high blood pressure in the lungs."
"I know what it is," Bree said, her voice tight.
"Or?"
"Or infective endocarditis. Or not."
"Will she die?" she asked bluntly, looking up at me. Her jaw was set, but I saw the way she held Amanda closer, waiting for an answer. I could give her nothing but the truth.
Probably.
The word hung in the air between us, hideous.
I can't say for sure, but...
Probably, Brianna echoed, and I nodded, turning away, unable to look at her face. Without such modern assistances as an echocardiogram, I, of course, couldn't judge the extent of the problem. But I had not only the evidence of my eyes and ears, but what I had felt passing from her skin to mine, that sense of not rightness, that eerie conviction that comes now and then.
Can you fix it?
I heard the tremor in Brianna's voice and went at once to put my arms around her. Her head was bent over Amanda, and I saw the tears fall, one, then another, darkening the wispy curls on top of the baby's head.
No,
I whispered, holding them both. Despair washed over me, but I tightened my hold as though I could keep time and blood both at bay.
No, I can't.
Well, there's no choice, is there?
Roger felt preternaturally calm, recognizing it as the artificial calm produced by shock, but wishing to cling to it as long as possible.
You've got to go.
Brianna leveled a look at him but didn't reply. Her hand roamed over the baby, sleeping in her lap, smoothing the woolly blanket over and over again. Claire had explained it all to him, more than once, patiently, seeing that he couldn't take it in. He still didn't believe it, but the sight of those tiny fingernails turning blue as Amanda strove to suck had sunk into him like an owl's talons.
It was, she had said, a simple operation, in a modern operating room. You can't, he'd asked, with a vague motion toward her surgery. With the ether.
She'd closed her eyes and shaken her head, looking nearly as ill as he felt. No. I can do very simple things. Hernias, appendixes, tonsils. And even those are a risk. But something so invasive on such a tiny body.
No,
she repeated, and he saw the resignation in her face when she met his eyes. No. If she's to live, you have to take her back. And so they had begun to discuss the unthinkable, because there were choices and decisions to be made. But the unalterable basic fact was clear. Amanda must go through the stones. If she could. Jamie Fraser took his father's ruby ring and held it over the face of his granddaughter. Amanda's eyes fixed on it at once, and she stuck out her tongue with interest. He smiled, despite the heaviness of his heart, and lowered the ring for her to grab at.
She likes that well enough,
he said, skillfully removing it from her grip before she could get it into her mouth.
Let's try the other.
The other was Claire's amulet, the tiny battered leather pouch given to her by an Indian wise woman years before. It contained assorted bits and bobs, herbs, he thought, and feathers, perhaps the tiny bones of a bat. But in among them was a lump of stone. Nothing much to look at, but a true gemstone, a raw sapphire. Amanda turned her head at once, more interested in the pouch than she had been in the shiny ring. She made cooing noises and batted wildly with both hands trying to reach it. Brianna took a deep, half-strangled breath.
Maybe, she said, in the voice of one who fears as much as hopes. But we can't tell for sure. What if I take her and I go through, but she can't?
They all looked at one another in silence, envisioning the possibility.
You'd come back,
Roger said gruffly, and put a hand on Bree's shoulder.
You'd come right back.
The tension in her body eased a little at his touch.
"I'd try," she said, and attempted a smile.
Jamie cleared his throat.
"Is we Jem about?"
Of course he was. He never went far from home or Brianna these days, seeming to sense that something was wrong. He was retrieved from Jamie's study, where he had been spelling out words in...
"Jesus Christ on a piece of toast," his grandmother blurted, snatching the book from him. "Jamie, how could you?"
Jamie felt a deep blush rise over him. How could he indeed? He'd taken the battered copy of Fanny Hill in trade, part of a parcel of used books bought from a tinker. He hadn't looked at the books before buying them, and when he did come to look them over, well, it was quite against his instincts to throw away a book. Any book.
"What's P-H-A-L-L-U-S?
Jemmy was asking his father.
"Another word for prick," Roger said briefly. "Don't bloody use it."
"Listen, can you hear anything when you listen to that stone?"
He indicated Jamie's ring lying on the table. Jem's face lighted at sight of it.
"Sure,"
he said.
"What, from there?"
Brianna said, incredulous. Jem looked around the circle of parents and grandparents, surprised at their interest.
"Sure," he repeated. "It sings."
"Do you think wee Mandy can hear it sing too?" Jamie asked carefully.
His heart was beating heavily, afraid to know either way. Jemmy picked up the ring and leaned over Mandy's basket, holding it directly over her face. She kicked energetically and made noises, but whether because of the ring or merely at the sight of her brother...
"She can hear it," Jem said, smiling into his sister's face.
"How do you know?" Claire asked, curious. Jem looked up at her, surprised.
"She says so."
Nothing was settled. At the same time, everything was settled. I was in no doubt as to what my ears and my fingers told me. Amanda's condition was slowly worsening. Very slowly. It might take a year, 2 years, before serious damage began to show. But it was coming. Jem might be right. He might not be. But we had to proceed on the assumption that he was.
There were arguments, discussions, tears. Not yet any decision as to who should attempt the journey through the stones.
Brianna and Amanda must go, that was certain. But ought Roger to go with them? Or Jemmy?
"I will not let you go without me,"
Roger said through his teeth.
"I don't want to go without you,"
Bree cried, looking exasperated.
"But how can we leave Jemmy here without us? And how can we make him go? A baby? We think that can work because of the legends. But Jem, how will he make it? We can't let him risk being killed."
I looked at the stones on the table. Jamie's ring, my pouch with the sapphire. "I think," I said carefully, "that we need to find 2 more stones, just in case." And so, in late June, we came down from the mountain into turmoil. Chapter 115. Nose Picker. July the 4th, 1776. It was close and hot in the inn room, but I couldn't go out. Little Amanda had finally fussed herself to sleep. She had a rash on her bottom, poor thing, and was curled in her basket, tiny thumb in her mouth, and a frown on her face. I unfolded the gauze mosquito knitting and draped it carefully over the basket, then opened the window. The air outside was hot too, but fresh and moving. I pulled off my cap. Without it, Mandy was fond of clutching my hair in both her hands and yanking. She had an amazing amount of strength for a child with a heart defect. For the millionth time, I wondered whether I could have been wrong. But I wasn't. She was asleep now, with the delicate rose bloom of a healthy baby on her cheeks. Awake and kicking,
That soft flush faded, and an equally beautiful but unearthly blue tinge showed now and then in her lips, in the beds of her tiny nails. She was still lively, but tiny. Bree and Roger were both large people. Jemmy had put on weight like a small hippopotamus through his first several years of life. Mandy weighed scarcely more than she had at birth. No, I wasn't wrong. I moved her basket to the table where the warm breeze could play over her and sat down beside it, laying my fingers gently on her chest. I could feel it, just as I had in the beginning, but stronger now that I knew what it was. If I had had a proper operating suite, the blood transfusions, the calibrated and carefully administered anesthesia, the oxygen mask, the swift, trained nurses. No surgery on the heart is a minor thing, and surgery on an infant is always a great risk. But I could have done it. Could feel in the tips of my fingers exactly what needed to be done. Could see in the back of my eyes the heart, smaller than my fist, the slippery, pumping, rubbery muscle, and the blood washing through the ductus arteriosus. A small vessel, no bigger than an eighth of an inch in circumference. A small nick in the axillary vessel, a quick ligation of the ductus itself with a number 8 silk ligature. Done. I knew. But knowledge is not, alas, always power. Nor is desire. It wouldn't be me who would save this precious granddaughter. Would anyone? I wondered, giving way momentarily to the dark thoughts I fought to keep at bay when anyone else was near. Jemmy might not be right. Any baby might grab at a brightly coloured, shiny thing like a ruby ring. But then I remembered her cooing, batting at my decrepit leather amulet pouch with the raw sapphire inside. Perhaps. I didn't want to think about the dangers of the passage, or the certainty of permanent separation, no matter whether the journey through the stones was successful or not. There were noises outside. I looked toward the harbour and saw the masts of a large ship far out to sea, another still further out. My heart skipped a beat. They were ocean-going ships, not the little packet boats and fishing smacks that sailed up and down the coast. Could they be part of the fleet, sent in answer to Governor Martin's plea for help to suppress, subdue, and reclaim the colony? The first ship of that fleet had arrived at Cape Fear in late April, but the troops it carried had been lying low, waiting for the rest. I watched for some time, but the ships didn't come in closer. Perhaps they were hanging off, waiting for the rest of the fleet. Perhaps they weren't British ships at all, but Americans, escaping the British blockade of New England by sailing south. I was distracted from my thoughts by the clumping of male feet on the stairs, accompanied by snorts, and that peculiarly Scottish sort of giggling, usually depicted in print, but by no means adequately, as huh-huh-huh. It was clearly Jamie and Ian, though I couldn't understand what was giving rise to so much hilarity, since when last seen, they had been bound for the docks, charged with dispatching a shipment of tobacco leaves, obtaining pepper, salt, sugar, cinnamon, if findable, and pins. Somewhat rarer than cinnamon, for Mrs. Bug, and procuring a large fish of some edible sort for our supper. They'd got the fish, at least. A large king mackerel. Jamie was carrying it by the tail, whatever it had been wrapped in having evidently been lost in some accident. His queue had come undone, so that long red strands frayed out over the shoulder of his coat, which in turn had a sleeve half wrenched off, a fold of white shirt protruding through the torn seam. He was covered with dust, as was the fish, and while the latter's eyes both bulged accusingly, one of his own was swollen nearly shut. "Oh, God," I said, burying my face in one hand. I looked up at him through splayed fingers. "Don't tell me. Neil Forbes." "Ach, no," he said, dropping the fish with a splat on the table in front of me.
"A wee difference of opinion with the Wilmington Chowder and Marching Society."
"A difference of opinion?" I repeated.
"Aye. They thought they'd throw us in the harbour, and we thought they wouldn't."
He slung a chair round with his boot and sat down on it backward, arms crossed on its back. He looked indecently cheerful, face flushed with sun and laughter.
"I don't want to know," I said, though of course I did.
I glanced at Ian, who was still sniggering quietly to himself, and observed that while he was slightly less battered than Jamie, he had one forefinger lodged in his nose up to the knuckle.
"Have you got a bloody nose, Ian?"
He shook his head, still giggling.
"No, Auntie. Some of the society do, though."
"Well, why have you got your finger up your nose, then? Have you picked up a tick or something?"
"No, he's keeping his brains from falling out," Jamie said, and went off into another fit.
I glanced at the basket, but Mandy slept peacefully on, quite used to racket.
"Well, maybe you'd best stick both your own fingers up your nose, then," I suggested. "Keep you out of trouble for a moment or two, at least."
I tilted up Jamie's chin to get a better look at the eye.
"You hit someone with that fish, didn't you?"
The giggling had died down to a subterranean vibration between them, but threatened at this to break out anew.
"Gilbert Butler,"
Jamie said, with a masterful effort at self-control.
"Smack across the face. Sent him straight across the quay and into the water."
Ian's shoulders shook with remembered ecstasy.
"Pride, what a splash. Oh, it was a braw fight, Auntie. I thought I'd broke my hand on a fellow's jaw, but it's all right now. The deadness has worn off. Just a bit numb and tingly."
He wiggled the free fingers of his hand at me in illustration, wincing only slightly as he did so.
"Do take your finger out of your nose, Ian," I said, anxiety over their condition fading into annoyance at how they'd got that way. "You look like a half-wit."
For some reason, they both found that hysterically funny and laughed like loons. Ian did, however, eventually withdraw the finger with an expression of wary cautiousness, as though he truly expected his brains to follow in its wake. Nothing did emerge, though. Not even the ordinary bits of unsavoury excreta one might expect from such a manoeuvre. Ian looked puzzled, then mildly alarmed. He sniffed, prodding experimentally at his nose, then stuck the finger back into his nostril, rooting vigorously. Jamie went on grinning, but his amusement began to fade as Ian's explorations became more frantic.
"What? You've not lost it, have you, lad?"
Ian shook his head, frowning.
"Nay, I feel it. It's..."
He stopped, giving Jamie a panic-stricken look over the embedded finger.
"It's stuck, Uncle Jamie. I can't get it out."
Jamie was on his feet at once. He pulled the finger from its resting place with a moist sucking noise, then tilted back Ian's head, peering urgently up his nose with his one good eye.
"Bring a light, Sassenach, will you?"
There was a candlestick on the table, but I knew from experience that the only likely effect of using a candle to look up someone's nose was to set their nose hairs on fire. Instead, I bent and pulled my medical kit out from under the settle where I had stowed it.
"I'll get it," I said, with the confidence of one who has removed everything from cherry pits to live insects from the nasal cavities of small children. I drew out my longest pair of thin forceps and clicked the slender blades together in token of assurance. "Whatever it is, just keep quite still, Ian."
The whites of Ian's eyes showed briefly in alarm as he looked at the shining metal of the forceps, and he looked pleadingly at Jamie.
"Wait, I've a better idea."
Jamie laid a quelling hand on my arm for an instant, then disappeared out the door. He thundered downstairs, and I heard a sudden burst of laughter from below as the door to the tap room opened. The sound was as suddenly cut off as the door closed, like the valve on a faucet.
"Are you all right, Ian?"
There was a smear of red on his upper lip. His nose was beginning to bleed,
aggravated by his jabbings and pokings.
"Well, I do hope so, Auntie."
His original jubilation was beginning to be replaced by a certain expression of worry.
"You didn't think I could have pushed it into my brain, do you?"
"I think it very unlikely."
"What on earth?"
But the door below had opened and closed again, spilling another brief spurt of talk and laughter into the stairwell. Jamie took the stairs two at a time and popped back into the room, smelling of hot bread and ale, and holding a small battered snuff box in his hand. Ian seized on this with gratitude, and sprinkling a quick pinch of black dusty grains on the back of his hand, hastily inhaled it. For an instant, all three of us held breathless. And then it came, a sneeze of gargantuan proportions that rocked Ian's body back on its stool, even as his head flew forward, and a small hard object struck the table